This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Plants can have a natural beauty, but in the hands of an artist, they can take on a beauty never possible in nature. We take a look at one Brazilian artist's work with plants. Well, not really plants, the byproduct of plants, which has been described as voluptuously magnificent, and that's putting it mildly. We'll talk to him later in the program. First, a different use for plants. A few years ago, we spoke with Richard Louv, author of Last Child in the Woods. He is passionate about getting kids outside and into nature. In fact, he's the man who coined the term nature deficit disorder. Well, that plays right into what our first guests are all about. They're part of the Green Teacher Network, which aims to expand school gardens across the CMS system because, they say, when children go out and work in those gardens, they learn better, the achievement gap closes a bit, childhood obesity can be reduced, and you can get rid of nature deficit disorder. That's a lot to ask of a garden, but we find out more about how this works with Edna Chirico, the executive director of the Catawba River District of the Green Teacher Network. You may remember that she was on the county commission many years ago. She's one of the people responsible for the establishment, I understand, of the network in this area. Good morning. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to see you. Bobby Mabe is also with us. She's a family advocate and gardener at Garinger High School. Are you in charge of the Garinger High School garden then?
I am in the school portion, and we're working with Friendship Gardens as well. They have a large urban farm going in, okay. So it's a big project.
Thank you for joining us. You're filling in for somebody who chickened out at the last minute. And Aaron Brighton is the director of the Mecklenburg County Food Policy Council. Who knew we had a food policy council?
Who knew? We do have one.
She's also an instructor at Central Piedmont Community College in their Department of Health and Physical Education. What is the Food Policy Council?
We are a nonprofit in Charlotte who serves to educate citizens, community members, city council, and important local food issues. So we work through education and advocacy and coordinate projects around the community.
And when did this start?
It was founded in 2009.
Okay.
And really, it's probably taken off more so in the past couple years, really grown. We probably have over 400 supporters right now in the Charlotte area.
Well, we're here to talk about the Green Teacher Network. What is that? When did it start? And why? And since you're one of the people responsible for starting it, Edna, I'll ask that question of you.
Well, thank you. The Green Teacher Network actually formed fairly organically. We started meeting different nonprofits as the Catawba River District expanded its collaboration of 11 schools in Northwest Charlotte and West Gaston County to focus on the academic effectiveness and the growth of the STEM skills in schoolyard gardens. So we started researching who else was involved and discovered that CMS thought that maybe 20, 25 schools were gardening. So we connected with the health department and did a survey of the schools involved in gardening and determined there were about 65 schools in CMS that were actively gardening.
Already, before
we came on. So we decided that we needed to get these schools together to help them understand more effective ways of gardening, to help them network with each other, and help them really get over the fear of getting out there and getting their hands in the dirt.
If they'd already done it, why did they need help? In other words, if somebody had the foresight to get kids out there and start growing things and connect them back to the food that they eat, why did they need some overseer organization to come in there and teach them how to do it better?
Because there are so many teachers out there who want to understand how to garden, mm-hmm. and they're afraid to take their children outside, their students outside. They're taught as teachers how to control their students within the four walls of their classroom. And many of our teachers really are disconnected with our food system, and they don't understand what happens when you plant a seed. We do surveys with our teachers and the students, and usually before we get involved in gardening, we ask them simple questions like, where do tomatoes come from? Number one answer generally is the grocery store. So they don't have the connection that you have to plant a seed to grow the tomato vine, and then they've never really tasted that fresh tomato off of the vine. Mm-hmm. So we're helping create a level of comfort and instruction on how to do all of this.
And I would guess many of them have probably never tasted a tomato.
No, and I mean, that's it's a wonderful
experience. Unless it's on a hamburger from and Burger King.
And the ones that you get through the fast food industry are grown so far away and so picked so early that they really don't have the flavor.
Right.
So we're trying to reengage our students in the wonders of the food ecosystem and at the same time really embed the effectiveness of hands-on learning.
So now I'm told there are over 90 school gardens.
Easily.
That are open or about to open in Mecklenburg and Gaston counties. Do you just deal with those two counties or do you deal with a broader area?
We opened up the Green Teacher Network and started doing quarterly workshops to invite not only the teachers and educators involved in our public schools in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, but also all of the schools in the surrounding region, and not just the public schools, but the private schools, the charter schools, the homeschoolers, and the nonprofits who are working in garden-supported education, because we believe that we have a wealth of resources and we can learn best from each other.
So, Bobby, you've been doing this at Garinger High School. Did you do it prior to the establishment of the Green Teacher Network?
I did. I was a garden leader at Shamrock Gardens Elementary, which is just down the road from Garinger. My kids actually go to school there.
Okay.
And I started there and saw the things that Edna's been talking about. I saw how it impacted the children and how many of them had never had fresh vegetables. And so, you know, we really kind of rolled out this great program at Shamrock. And now that I'm at Garinger as an employee, I'm wanting to do the same thing there.
What is the reaction of kids who don't have any experience working with plants, who think that tomatoes come from the grocery store and don't eat a lot of vegetables because they live in a food desert and they eat fast food? What is their reaction when they find out, my gosh, this ground grows peas, it grows lima beans, it grows asparagus?
Well, it's fabulous. We have so many kids have said things that stay in my mind, and one of them is, you know, kids will look at broccoli and say, what is that?
Little trees.
Right. And I say, that's broccoli. That's what it looks like when it's actually growing. And that's how it grows. And that's how it gets to the grocery stores, is it grows out here like this. And another, you know, a lot of the kids, their parents will actually contact me and say, you know, thanks to you, we have to start our own gardens because our children are saying that they want fresh vegetables. They want to harvest their own vegetables.
Are they thanking you or are they blaming you?
They're actually thanking. Yes, I will help them build gardens if that's what they want to do. I'm happy to do it.
So. Edna mentioned that some teachers were afraid of they know how to control the kids in the classroom, but they were afraid of taking them outdoors into this vast open space. How, you know, kids get dirty, and gardening is not clean.
That's right.
And there's the rest of the school day to go through. How do you keep them clean?
I don't. I encourage them to go ahead and dig and get dirty. And what I say is there are sinks and hand soap, and we can wash your hands, and you can go through the rest of your day.
But you have to get down on your knees, and you get your pants dirty and your shoes dirty. How do the parents feel about that?
I have never had a complaint about a child being dirty from school. They go home with such excitement and stories about what they've learned and what they've done in the garden that I've never had a complaint from a parent.
We talked a second ago, Aaron, about the about the existence of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Food Policy Council. But why do we have one? I mean, do other cities have food policy councils?
Sure. There are food policy councils growing in many communities. And one of the projects that I'm working on right now is helping the counties surrounding Mecklenburg County develop their own food policy councils, probably in the 14 surrounding counties in surrounding the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area.
So,
there are only four right now.
What kinds of things have you gotten involved in with the county commission or the city councils and whoever else you work with?
We work a lot with CMS. We work a lot with the health department, trying to focus on issues that are important. How do we get all of our families access to good, healthy food? How can we support local farmers? How can we support North Carolina agriculture? Because by creating this desire for local food, we're also, you know, helping our local economy here and supporting our farmers markets and our local food trucks and mobile produce.
And you talk about wanting to remove the barriers to healthy food that are faced by some children. What are the barriers? What are some of the barriers?
Well, depending on where they're located, you used the term food desert before. There are definitely parts of this city, this region, where kids don't have access to fresh, healthy food close to their home. So they're really limited in what they have. And by creating all these school gardens and having that opportunity at school and bringing local chefs in through a Chef's Move to School program or an I Tasted It, I Planted It program, you're getting kids to be excited about food they might not have access to, and then they can go and seek it out.
Well, last fall, you got a grant from Burt's Bees, and also you were able to take that money and add new vegetables to the school, I guess, was it school menus or school gardens?
We did, both.
Like sweet potatoes and kale. I just want to go on the record. I'm very much opposed to kale. So what happens to these vegetables? Do they actually go into the cafeteria?
That is an ongoing project. It's an awesome project. We work with the school cafeterias. The school cafeteria managers have the ability to control some specialty items on their menu. So they'll put sweet potatoes on their menu for October, and we'll go into the classroom and make sweet potato pancakes. Bobby, you were one of the people who are working on that project. And then the students are seeing it in the cafeteria. They're seeing a poster about it in the hall. They made a recipe in their classroom. They tasted it. They went home with the recipe, brought it home to their parents. We made a massage kale salad one day with herbs and vinaigrette.
Let's be clear, the children who tasted the kale, they are still alive.
They are still alive.
I just want to make sure of that.
There was no kale left. They went home and asked for more kale.
What is wrong with these children?
So, just like Bobby, I had parents saying, my child ate what? They ate kale? They are asking for kale. If you have that experience and this positive experience when you're younger, it's something that stays with you and grows, and you have that. You're bringing that home to your parents, and you're influencing what they're eating.
Edna.
North Carolina is fairly new at this whole garden experience, but we're learning from the experts coming out of California, like Alice Waters and her edible schoolyards. She has proven that if you help a child plant the seed, tend the plant, harvest the plant, teach them how to prepare the food, then they've changed their life. They will continue to eat and grow and garden throughout their life. But if you miss one of those components, then your likelihood of continuing that good habit declines.
Bobby, you're over there nodding. Obviously, you've seen this happen with the children you've worked with.
Yes, I have. I've had most of my experience with elementary school age children, and you can just see it. It's so easy to see that.
So many kids don't like it. They won't try vegetables. And when they try them, they don't like them. What's up with that?
Well, actually, most of the kids, my rule in the classroom is I've explained to them, you don't have to like it, but you have to try it.
Right.
And mostly they do. I mean, we have so much fun, and I think it's different than having to sit in a classroom and be very serious and, you know, try to learn different skills. This is just fun to them.
Wasn't there an I Tried It initiative going on
that
in the schools?
That is a project that we are doing through the Burt's Bees grant.
Okay.
They go home with a sticker that, you know, I tried local greens. There's a big kale on their chest. They walk through the halls with their kale sticker, their sweet potato sticker. So they're proud of it. After they try it, they get their sticker. And they wear that proudly all day long.
Kale, I don't get. What's not to like about sweet potatoes?
I don't think there's anything not to like about sweet potatoes. But just it goes back to understanding where it comes from, that these are all vegetables that these kids are growing in their own gardens, harvesting, and then seeing how they can transform that vegetable into something delicious.
Now, do the schools get involved in regulating the gardens on their campuses in any particular way?
Yes, to a certain extent. And that's something we're helping with, because each principal controls their campus, but yet there's a lot of centralization that goes on. So we're working with another team, including Friendship Gardens and the Food Policy Council, to develop a local schoolyard garden guide, which we hope to release in the spring. It really talks about growing seasons here, the curriculum connections, the opportunity to enhance your learning, but also puts into place some of the policies that the school systems have. One of the challenges that the Food Policy Network the Green Teacher Network and the Food Policy Council is working on are state laws. We have laws that say you can grow food in your schoolyard garden, you can do tastings in your classroom, but you're not allowed to use that food that you grow in the school cafeteria.
Yes, and I want to talk about that after the break, because that just seems perverse to me to a certain degree, at least. Edna Cherico is with us. She's the executive director of the Catawba River District Green Teacher Network. Bobby Mabe is a family advocate and gardener at Garinger High School, and Aaron Brighton is director of the Mecklenburg County Food Policy Council. We're taking a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Acura, introducing the new fuel-efficient 2014 RDX and MDX sport utility vehicles with up to 90 cubic feet of convertible cargo space. Details at hendrickacura.com. There's an old saying. Your grandmother said this to you. Maybe your mother said this to you. You are what you eat. And no one knows that better than our guest tomorrow, Vani Hari. She was plagued for years with unexplained illnesses until she decided to look into what it was she was putting into her body through the food she was eating. Well, she found out a lot of things, and she changed her habits and through a blog began spreading the word about what she was doing. That's now become a website called, are you ready? Foodbabe.com. And she's gotten the attention of some major food producers in America. She joins us tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a chemical spill left 300,000 West Virginians without safe tap water. Now, weeks later, officials say they've identified a second chemical, an update on the spill, and safeguarding America's drinking water.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
Hey, Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Green Teacher Network, a network of teachers who are green, who run gardens at the various schools around the area, which is something that is a phenomenon that is growing and growing. And one of the things that Edna Cherico mentioned just before we went to the break, and I think this is rather perverse, is that these kids are out there successfully growing their own vegetables, learning where their food comes from, learning to like new foods that they would probably never have been exposed to and who would probably just turn their nose up at had they not grown it and been forced to taste it, at least taste it, you know. But that food, which is perfectly good and very healthy, cannot be served in the school's cafeteria. Why not?
There's a North Carolina state law called the North Carolina Gap Legislation that requires food to be processed to ensure that it's safe before it goes into the school cafeteria. So that means that fresh food is not processed and doesn't get to be served in the school cafeteria. Now, we have wonderful people within the CMS nutrition program that like to see that changed, but we have a lot of levels of regulation at the state. So that's one of the things that Aaron's been working on as well, to try to get flexibility as this new phenomenon, schoolyard gardens, continues to grow.
That is. You know, so GAP, so we're talking about GAP certification, and which stands for Good Agricultural Practices, and it's a financial barrier for some farms to get that. You have to get, it's an annual audit. You pay about $300 to $500 per crop per farm. So if you're talking about a schoolyard garden,
it's unaffordable.
Really, that's not affordable. It's not.
One of the things that you mentioned, Edna, off the air is that, well, this food is no good if you don't do something with it. If you don't eat it, what's the point? It could be a tulip that you're growing. And so if you're going to eat it, you better cook it right. And you brought with you today one of the chefs that works with you, Sean Cosby, who not only works in the schools as part of this program, but has his own company called Adopt a Chef. If I adopt you, Sean, what do I get?
Great question. Well, I guess you get all that we're talking about here, you know, the healthier food, the greater options, but adopting, you know, more importantly, you get me as a part of your family, you know, so it doesn't just feel like you're just hiring me. So you get everything you want.
So you come cook? Is that what you do?
Yeah, I do. I come inside the homes. There can be dinner parties, birthday parties, whatever you need, or I have a few clients that I do meals for, you know, throughout the week. So I come in on Sunday and do meals for the whole week.
So that I would think that keeps you pretty busy, and because the restaurant business, whether you're a caterer or you're in the business, is the hardest business in the world. It's a 24/7 business, and you're up early and you're up late. How do you have time, and what do you get out of participating in this program for children?
Great question. Well, this is totally on a different spectrum than the restaurants that you talked about. When you're done with those 100-hour weeks, I guess you got to kind of do something that kind of gives back to the community. You want to feel good about what you're doing. Sometimes in the chef world, you're cooking, you're serving people, but you really don't feel that people are really understanding what that food does, where it comes from, and exactly what it does for you. So being a part of the Green Teacher Network, mm-hmm. I think it makes you feel better inside. As we talked about earlier, I'm from, you know, a different environment where we really thought tomatoes were ketchup, in my honest opinion, to tell you the truth.
President Reagan thought so.
Exactly. So it makes you feel good inside to kind of do something for your community, and it feels like people really understand what the food is about and where it comes from.
Somewhere here in this little packet of information, I have a recipe for something I think that you came up with that we're putting on our website today. I can't find it right now, but is it what was it for? I can't even remember. You don't remember either.
He did a recent taping with Sean at the Piedmont Natural Gas Kitchens. Okay. He's one of our demonstration chefs. He's a Johnson & Wales graduate.
Right.
And he worked with Megan Lambert, and they did a stem salad and salad dressing.
Okay.
So parts of a plant, stem salad. And there are video demonstrations on our website, and I think you're putting a link on your website. So Sean is such a great role model, showing that there are a lot of options, career options related to schoolyard garden, everything from engineering to understanding the whole culinary and hospitality industry.
And you'll be part of this thing that this organization is doing at the Southern Spring Show. You have something called the Ultimate Schoolyard Garden, and you'll have
yes.
a display there. And also Sean and other chefs will be there
doing demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to show the maximum opportunities with schoolyard gardens. And it's not just raised bed gardens. It's everything from gardening to understanding plants to the whole food ecosystem to the things related to gardening, like aquaponics, which is hydroponic gardening, and fish farming in a closed-loop water system. How gardening can connect to each part of the curriculum, each subject matter, and into career awareness.
So at some of these schools, you're telling me you're raising fish?
It's happening out at Garinger, yes.
Really? What kind of fish are you raising?
It'll be tilapia. Actually, a group called 100 Gardens is partnering with us, and they know so much about aquaponics, and they're doing a great job of setting that up out there. And so we will have students involved in that, monitoring the water and feeding the fish and really running that program once it's set up.
Since you've been doing this for years, first at Shamrock and, mm-hmm. and then at Garinger,
right.
how big do these plots of land have to be to make them able to accommodate not just the food that you're growing, but the kids who are in there working in the garden?
Right. Well, what I have found that works best is that I attach a classroom to a bed, and that bed can be as small as 4x4 or 4x8. And actually, you can get a lot of produce out of a bed that size. We will do a tasting for an entire class, and they'll sometimes come up for seconds and thirds, and we have enough, and sometimes we have enough to send home with them.
Mm.
So that's one of the great lessons, is that when we're dealing with populations that sometimes don't have their own land space or funds to do what they think they need to do in a garden, it's great to point out that you don't need a lot of space. We've started with the high schoolers building portable table gardens, and we'll take that to their homes, and we'll build them there, and then I form this relationship with them to bring them the soil and the seeds and teach them how to do this at home when they don't have yard space.
Right.
So how
many children, what's the ideal number of people involved in taking care of a garden? Because if you have more than one class going out there and doing what they're doing, somebody has to manage and coordinate all of this. What's the biggest number of people you should
accommodate? My idea is to have 100% participation at schools, but I do it by
really?
Classroom, and I want them to have ownership over their bed, which is why I attach each class to a bed, because then they know it's their space. So I facilitate them planting and harvesting and cooking, but they view that children will come to me and say, when is our produce ready? So that's really important to have them.
So
have that relationship.
Sean, do you come in and when it's harvest time, are you one of the people that comes in and talks about how to prepare these vegetables?
I will be pretty soon. I mean, the whole mandate is going to get really big really soon, so I'm pretty excited about it. And whatever needs to get done, I'll be there.
I mean, we don't have to go into your personal life, but I'm told that that a lot of these young people who come from at-risk neighborhoods don't go out and play a lot because their parents feel it's dangerous, or their parents are not home, and they've told them when you get home from school, you go home, you close the door, and you stay inside. So getting outside to grow these things is one thing, but they're also not exposed to a lot of these things. They don't know what to do with them once they've got them. What are you finding when you're exposing kids to new foods prepared in ways perhaps that they have never experienced?
Great question. Well, I'm finding that surprisingly kids are excited about it. I wish I had this when I was younger myself. At first you may get the small, what is that? I don't know what that is. I don't want to try it. But once you let kids know, like Bobby said earlier, just try it. Once you try things, you have your opinion after that. But for the most part, kids are excited. They want to know more. They want to learn about it. And you'll be surprised. They really want to get down and dirty and, do everything possible to learn where it comes from and mm-hmm. the whole process from A to Z.
How did you get involved? How did you become interested in this yourself as a career?
Good question. Actually, from around 14, I knew that I had to figure out something about life. And I knew that food was pretty big to me, big passion to me. And I grew up as a foster kid. And really, food was a big problem, finding food, getting seconds, things like this. So coincidentally, I think the passion to find out more about food and the lack of food for myself kind of made me get into this career field. And I really wanted to, teach people more about food, learn more about food, and just see exactly, what food could do for me and everybody else.
Edna, the Catawba River District is collaborating with this Green Teacher Network on what we already talked about a little bit, called the Ultimate Schoolyard Garden. And you've got professionals coming in to work on garden design. You've got carpentry classes at CPCC involved in, I guess, designing and building raised beds, et cetera. You've got a couple of master horticulturalists coming in, organizing the growing of, what, 2,000 different plants? All of this for school garden?
Absolutely.
And they're like
doing
a farm.
And they're doing the gardening in raised bed recycled pallets. So it's going to be an amazing opportunity for teachers, regardless of their skill level, to come and see how they can develop a window box, all the way to how they can do renewable energy in their garden, understand ozone, which is air quality indicator plants, the whole array. And we're rolling this all into a website, gtncharlotte.org, where we're going to put videos so that you can't get Sean to replicate himself and go out to all the schools, but they're going to be able to see him in a video doing a demonstration of how to do a tasting in your classroom. We also have really cool things like a mobile chicken tractor. Worked with the health department, the school system, so we now have four hands that can go out to certain schools, arrives on a Monday morning, gets assigned to a classroom. They observe the hens, gather the eggs, really understand where chicken and eggs come from, whether it's your egg McMuffin to your chicken nuggets, and how chickens are involved. And you don't just get the egg magically appearing in the grocery store.
We used the word STEM salad a second ago, and I thought you were going to take it into the STEM education area, because
Absolutely. That's
one of the things that you say, experts say, this helps. And I don't understand how it helps. STEM education is what? Science, technology,
engineering, and math.
And math. So how are students helped to excel or exceed or succeed in that area just by working in a garden?
If you think about it, gardening and culinary skills are all wrapped in science and math. You have to measure everything. You have to understand the science and the evolution of how the seed becomes a plant and how it matures, the engineering involved in building your schoolyard garden. There's something called a learning pyramid, where if you're in the classroom, you can probably retain about 20-25% of what you learn. But if you can take those same learning components and put them out in the garden and have the students really involved with their hands in the learning experience, you raise that retention level up to as high as 75%.
And there's an empirical evidence that says
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
There is.
There's a
yes.
lot.
Can schools profit? If you can't serve the food being grown in the cafeteria,
can
you have a farmer's market?
They can do that. And that is absolutely legal. And it could be a fundraiser. It's something that we're talking about doing at Garinger. It is going on at some schools in the Charlotte area. And you are able to sell the produce you grow in your farmer's market and in your backyard, schoolyard garden.
And we'd like to take it a step further. We want to teach our schools, especially our high schools, how to understand the food industry. We've been trying to figure out, Aaron and I are still working on this, how could we do something as creative as actually manufacturing ketchup at one of our high schools using locally grown tomatoes? We'll never be able to get enough tomatoes at a high school level, but helping farmers connect at the high school level. There are so many skills that could be developed and career awareness that could be infused into the learning experience if you could figure out how to get through the legislation to make that happen.
Bobby.
I'd like just to add that with all the hands-on things, other problems can be solved. So at Garinger, we didn't have the funds to finish a project. So one of the classes decided that they were going to start a cafe, and they're going to start selling coffee in the mornings to raise money for the garden. So it's not – the garden can really mean so many things and be in integrated in so many different ways. Not everybody has to get out there and dig, but, you know, all this problem-solving and creativity. And these kids did it themselves. So Wildcat Cafe is out there now every morning selling.
As a chef, I'm sure that you work with all kinds of things other than just vegetables. But when you're dealing with kids growing food in a garden, there's not a lot of beef out there. So what kinds of things are you restricted to teaching them how to cook?
Great question again. Well, I think you can easily find beef or, you know, poultry or chicken anywhere out there. So I think the bigger problem is fruits and vegetables. So I think that's the biggest, you know, missing component in most of the meals. So I think kids are pretty excited about the fact that they don't eat these things already. So they want to learn, you know, mostly about vegetables and fruits. I think anybody can go to a grocery store and find out about chicken, but you want to do something a little different, a little interactive, and something a little different.
Where do you hope all this goes in the next 5 or 10 years?
That we have sustainable children. That we have children who are self-sufficient and connected to the real world, that they're succeeding academically and really understand how to connect energy to food, to life skills.
Edna Cherico is the executive director of the Catawba River District Green Teacher Network. Bobby Mabe is a family advocate and gardener at Geringer High School. Aaron Brighton, the director of Mecklenburg County Food Policy Council. And Sean Cosby, who is teaching these kids how to cook with these vegetables and runs his own thing called Adopt-A-Chef. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate it. From plants to grow and harvest for food to plants being used in a completely different but artistic way. Brazilian artist Henrique Oliveira is known for monumental art installations. These enormous works are constructed of strips of weathered plywood. You see, plywood started as a plant that he finds around his hometown in Sao Paulo in Brazil. And these installations have been described as voluptuously magnificent. Some of his work is going on display beginning January 31st at UNC Charlotte. And Henrique Oliveira joins us for the remainder of the hour. Good morning. Welcome to Charlotte.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Krista Camarato, the Director of Galleries for the College of Arts and Architecture at UNC Charlotte, which has galleries in the Corporate City Center location and in the Storrs Architecture Building on the main campus. And Enrique's work is going to be here in the downtown area. Is that correct?
Yes, and we've kept the whole process of creating that work open for the past 3 weeks so that people can see the whole process
as it's being done.
Yes.
So you have you brought works with you from Brazil? I know you are creating some new things here, but have you brought some things with you and are creating also, or are you just beginning from scratch?
No, I'm just working with materials that I found here. Some part of this material was bought here, and other things we found in different places as scrap yards, landfills, dumpsters.
This is what makes your work so darned interesting, because it's difficult to describe verbally. You really have to see it, and we'll have links up on our website so that people can see your work as we talk about it. But it is kind of unlike anything I've ever seen. Where did the ideas come from?
Well, it came out of many years of researching specific materials, used plywood that I collect from dumpsters in São Paulo. And I take these boards to my student and I delaminate them. And this was first made into flat surfaces, like collages on the wall, mm-hmm. like paintings. And slowly I developed them into three-dimensional shapes, creating like bubbles, and in other occasions working more deeply into painting quality of these materials, like layering, working with colors, playing with textures, and also building sculpture-like textures, like a little oil and pastel texture enlarged into this big space.
We're going to break all that down, because that's a lot of information to ingest for somebody who's not been able to see what we're talking about, but we'll break it all down as we go through this conversation. But as I understand it, you would go around Sao Paulo or your hometown, and you would find that they put up a lot of construction fences, and they use cheap plywood, and they don't paint it, and it sits out there in the weather, and it gets nasty, and they take it down, and they put up new stuff. So you just take the old stuff and make art out of it. Now, what kind of an eye does it take to walk down the street and see some discarded piece of junk and go, I can do something with that and make a work of art out of it?
Yeah, this work started when I was in art school. And I was, for a couple of years, I was watching a fencing that was closing a construction site just across the street. And I was looking at this plywood going down, and then that's how the idea came up.
Well, we'll get more into that, too. We have to take a break. We're going to talk more about Henrique Oliveira's work that you can see at UNC Charlotte's downtown campus beginning January 31st when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Opera Carolina performing Puccini's Il Trittico, three short operas, including the comedic Johnny Schicchi, January 18th, 23rd, and 26th in the Belk Theater. More information at operacarolina.org. A chemical spill left 300,000 West Virginians without safe tap water, and now weeks later, officials say they've identified a second chemical. An update on the spill and safeguarding Americans' water supply coming up in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. We made a misstatement. We're not talking about plants as art, but we are going to be talking about what happens to plants when they become wood and then they become art in just a couple of seconds. And you can see our guest, Enrique Olivier's work, or Oliveira's work, on our Facebook page. You just go over to Charlotte Talks on our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks, and we are coming right back.
I'm veteran newsman Carl Castle. My role on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is to keep Peter Sagal in line. Your role is to hand over your car keys. See, we can turn your old car into your favorite programs. Give me a Civic. Bam! I'll turn it into Morning Edition. A Lexus. Pow! All things considered. An 85 Yugo. Car talk's all we could get out of that one. Turn your car into the programs you love.
Donate your car through Car Talk's vehicle donation program.
Go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Enrique Oliveira is our guest. He's an artist from Sao Paulo, Brazil, whose work will go on display at the UNC Charlotte downtown campus January 31st through March the 12th. Also with us, Krista Camarato, Director of Galleries at the College of Arts and Architecture at UNC Charlotte. Now let's go back. Let's back up, because this is hard to understand for people who have not seen your work. You do sculptures, you do installations, and by installations, I mean these gargantuan works that literally take over the space, and you use junk, pieces of wood. You were able to successfully do this in Sao Paulo, but the rules there are different, and as I understand it, you've done this elsewhere in the United States at other installations that you've created, and you've gone around and done the same thing you did in Sao Paulo. You've been doing it here, and we'll see some of our discarded wood and other things up in the galleries at UNC Charlotte. But I'm also told that it's difficult because we don't have a lot of trash, the right kind of trash.
Yeah, what we can find here very much is plywood in the amount that I find in Brazil, and the same quality, the quality I mean, because it's quite a cheap material in Brazil. So like people use it and they just dump it because it stays outside for a few months and then it falls apart. And here people use more durable material. They can reinstall it. And as fencing for construction sites. Mm-hmm. And but I don't work only with found plywood. I also work with other found materials. And that's what I have been doing here. So here in Charlotte, I'm using other objects like tires, inner tubes, and flooring wood. I'm using a carpet pad, lots of other things.
That's what you're finding, isn't it? I read that our trash is different, that we have a theme with our trash. It is carpets, pads, tires, and lots of things from home.
That's right.
That's what you're finding. As you've done this elsewhere in the country, is there a pattern developing in our trash? Are you seeing a similarity from city to city?
Yes. what I found here in Charlotte is similar to what I found in Cleveland. I was in Cleveland 2 years ago doing a project at the Museum of Contemporary Art. And I went to some scrapyards and landfills, and I found I have noticed that in the United States, it's kind of materials and objects are recurrent in these places, you know.
Now, the works that I've seen of yours, most of them, I think, were from Brazil, installations in and around Brazil. And what is really neat about them to me is that they're sculptural, but they're also fluid. Sculpture meaning that it's a solid piece, but there's so much fluidity and so much movement in these pieces. And much of that movement comes from the way you've manipulated it. Much of the movement, I think, also comes from just simply the way it came to you from the trash pile, and then the way you have chosen to color it.
Yeah.
Talk about that, because it's almost like a painting in that you have layered these things. A painting has a base, and then you build up onto the base, and you've done the same thing with these enormous installation pieces.
Yeah, that's right, because this work was born out of my experience as a painter.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to be a painter prior to start working with installations. And I did a research when I was in art school on the material point of view, how objects are made related to painting, how it can be used in a language that's bidimensional but advanced into the three-dimensional, like how I'm talking about collages, assemblage, like how this different objects can be put together to create an image of a painting. And when I was in art school, as I told before, and I saw this fence falling apart, and I pulled the first piece of plywood, and it broke, like, it gave me an idea that it was like a brush stroke. And this gave all dynamics to my works, you know, to start these installations. First as a flat surface, mm-hmm. and then slowly I started to explore this quality of flexibility of this laminate.
Is there a, when you start from the base of these big pieces, are you just building a frame or some kind of a flat surface upon which you attach all of these interesting pieces that you found? How does it begin for you?
Well, I started only with the found plywood, but then slowly I started to bring other materials to combine with this that would give a possibility to make more plastic things and more free forms. So one of the materials that I use mostly today is a bender board, which is a kind of flexible plywood, and I cut into strips, and I build like an armature, and then I peel, I take these laminates, and I work as a kind of skin covering the structure. Mm. Sometimes I use also PVC tubes to create round shapes, combining this property of elasticity of this plastic with the dryness of the wood. And that's what makes the work sometimes feel like it's something alive. Right. It's like somehow bringing life back into this dead wood.
And that's exactly what it feels like when you look at this stuff. I mean, it looks like it. I want to talk about some of these other things that look like they're actually oozing out of the surface, but they look positively alive. Krista Camarato is the director of galleries at UNC Charlotte. And I read about Enrique that he's a painter and he's a sculptor, but because of the way he works and what he does with the materials that he uses, he's not just a painter or a sculptor. He's the essence of a real artist because he sees things in objects unrelated to art and somehow makes art out of them. Is that an accurate thing to say?
That's a very accurate description. I think he actually almost energetically draws things that have a history from our garbage, which took a long time when we were here. We had to look at a lot of different places. So he seems to soak those up and then designs the liquidity of form, which I was really glad that you noticed, because I think his formal quality is so reliable and so imaginative that he's been highly successful in everything he's done. The process of doing everything that we did in the gallery was very interesting. It was interesting to see it from day one. He was very adamant about making sure that we could see the surface first. So he almost worked backwards as a collage artist. He wanted to see what he was going to paint with on the surface before he made this volumetric form. Hmm. So after we could find some skin, he sat in the gallery and did his sketches for a long time. And all of his sketches, I think, really, the objects or the forms that he was creating really kind of had this equation where things were going in and possibly coming out, and the volume followed that movement.
And the pieces that I've seen, although there is a similarity to them, there's a thematic similarity, you know that's your work, they're different. They're not the same. And so many contemporary or abstract artists may sometimes fall into this trap of, well, I was successful with this, so let's make the next one look kind of like this again. There's not a lot of that in your work. It's very different, and it's very specific, it seems to me, to the site that you're constructing these on. When you come into an empty space and you've collected some materials, what do you see? How do you make it happen?
It varies a lot depending on the space I'm dealing with. Sometimes, like what I'm doing here in Charlotte, is not necessarily related to the space in terms of architecture, but more in terms of how the gallery was built as a light of box of light, in the sense that it has natural light coming from both sides. It feels a little bit like a glass box where you can put like a species, like something kind of related to Natural History Museum. And so I thought this space as a place where I could create something like more like freestanding sculpture, but somehow it's made into zoomorphic forms and through combining with a scale of monumentality, which is also an anti-monumentality in the sense that it's made of trash and it combines parts that are just objects, just like things in the space, yeah, with other parts that are more like sculpture worked forms that in sometimes representational.
That seems to be pretty brave what you do, because it's like an actor coming into town to be in a play that hasn't been written or rehearsed, but you have a start date, and a start date certain, January 31st, and there better be something on the walls and in the room on January 31st. Does it ever make you nervous that you're not going to be able to pull it off, particularly if you're coming into a strange town whose trash you don't know?
I kind of know what I'm going to find, and if I don't find anything, I can also work with new materials. Not everything that I made are made of trash, you know, like many things in my production are made of new things, and sometimes just like intervention in the space with the same material that the walls are built.
Right. You've done an installation, I'm not sure where it is, but it looks positively space age and almost alien. It was all white with these curved surfaces that people could be surrounded by, walk through. You had a soundtrack of water running or dripping in the background, and that's not made out of trash.
No, we made that in the Galleria Milan, which represents me in São Paulo. And I just made an installation that it was like the gallery was empty, and I just made an intervention in the space. So it was like there was no artwork, or if the artwork was like just a strange power that was pressing the walls and the ceiling and lifting up the floor. And so it was just an idea of deformation in the space without not a space that contains an artwork, but just an intervention.
Because some of the installations that we're talking about here are installations in which you, the viewer, are part. You're in the middle of it. You're walking through it. It's bigger than you, and you're walking into it. Is that going to happen at UNC Charlotte, or is the space big enough for that?
No, in Charlotte, I created a freestanding piece, and you can walk around it. So it's another relationship with the body, not inside the work, but the work is inside the room.
One of the pieces that you did, and I guess this is in São Paulo, that I really love, and I wish you could do it here, although they probably arrest you. you found an old mansion that was kind of fallen into rack and ruin and decay, and you... I don't know how to describe this. You added to it so that these pieces of the installation look like they're oozing out of the broken windows and the cracks in the door and in places where maybe the mortar has separated. This stuff is just coming out solid, but it looks like it's oozed out over a long time as though there's something in there wanting desperately to get out.
Yeah, it was. This installation was made in Porto Alegre, a town south of Brazil, during the 7th edition of the Bienal do Mercosul, and it was somehow it worked as the opposite of most of my installations. Instead of being having this rough material as a contrast with the white pristine environment of the gallery, it was like the material going back to its original place. So it was the wood was combined in a way that it was as it had grown from this building. The building was very old, and all the walls were just aged surface, and so it had a totally different relationship than I usually happened in my work. So it was, as someone said, it was like the kind of the abandoned building was throwing up all this stuff from what was inside it. And somehow it was also rebuilding the fencing device that I call tapumes, that it's called tapumes in Brazil, which like covering this construction site. And it was like building it again, but in a different way. it was like a condition they put to me, like you can build the sculpture, but you have to make sure that people cannot enter the building. So it had to work as a fence.
Huh. How did you find Enrique?
That's a very good question. I think what he mentioned earlier about we have this really interesting gallery that seems to be a kind of a light box with two glass sides that are 22 feet long. It really lends itself to a different kind of artwork.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew automatically when I started in the gallery 2.5 years ago when it first opened that it needed a lot of installation work.
Yeah.
And I knew that because we're a UNC Charlotte gallery and we're new in the downtown arena, they needed to see all the exciting people we could bring in from around the world. So you put those two things together, and I'm hunting for installation artists from around the world. Well, then, if you put Enrique's aesthetics in there, they're somewhat undeniable. You see those curves and the liquidity of form, and you become they're almost addictive. And even though he's not formulaic, and everything he does in every new place comes out totally different.
And I only have a minute left, but a lot of it strikes me as being architectural, as an architectural component to his work.
I think
since you're the College of Arts and Architecture, it seems to be a great marriage.
It is a great marriage. It is. And they're architectural in their size almost always.
Is there anybody else doing anything remotely like this? I just have never seen anything
like this. I think this is the first time we have something like this in the Southeast, and that was important to us to do that.
It's pretty amazing stuff. And he does have standards about his trash.
High standards, actually.
Yes, it cannot stink. It has to bend.
Yes.
And there have to be large quantities of it. What do you hope people take away from this? Because this is going to be a different experience for many people as they go through these galleries.
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, part of our mission is to excite the environments that we occupy, and I think that's exactly what he's doing. He's exciting the environment, which is already a very different kind of environment. And I think they affect the viewer in a body sense. The viewer walks in, and they're undeniable. You're confronted by a form that's larger than you.
And very quickly, because I have 30 seconds, this is an installation that you're building on the site specific to this gallery. What happens on March the 12th when this closes? Does it disassemble and go away forever, or do you take it down and put it someplace else?
That question, I think Krista can respond better.
We're under negotiations about how we could possibly take it apart and put it on the back green for a little while.
You can see Enrique Olivero's work on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. But better yet, you can go see it in person beginning January 31st through March 12th at the UNC Charlotte downtown campus. Enrique, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here. Krista Camerato, the Director of Galleries for the College, also with us. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.